No? Can you hear me?
Still the same, the speakers don't seem to work.
Everything is full power. Now? Anything? Yes?
Yes.
Very good, yeah. Okay, so this is natural computing, a course which was taught last year or during the last years under the title Genetic Algorithms and Genetic Programming. Mainly a name change for the moment, but the course has developed into a more general collection of different methods and algorithms, and so I thought at some point this accumulation of material beyond genetic algorithms should also be reflected in the title. Apparently on the outside in the system it hasn't arrived yet, but I think in most other documents it should be called natural computing. So before going to technical details, maybe we try a slightly simplistic approach. What is natural? We don't have to discuss this here very much. We just rely on what sciences tell us, physics, chemistry, biology. So this will be pretty much everything what we consider to be natural here in this context. Computation is a much more difficult notion, especially when considering that you are experts in computation by now. Yeah, it has something to do with performing certain, to stay within this simplistic framework, to perform some physical, usually physical phenomena, to carry out certain mechanical or electrical operations that happen to be very similar to what we have defined in mathematics. So this can be, for example, a slide ruler, where simple geometric relations reflect the logarithmic structure useful for multiplication, or we can design it in a more intricate way in this 19th century or earlier gear-driven calculating machines by Leonardo da Vinci already. And more recently, all these different electrical parts, mainly similar in function, but at different levels of integration, allow us to perform essentially binary operations that we can construct into larger assemblies of functions, which allow us to do essentially everything what we can do. But by now it's already visible that certain limits are soon to be reached, and these three dots indicate that we should maybe look for other possibilities of using physical. I guess now, by now, these handouts should have run out. Can you maybe show who, if you haven't got any of these? No, maybe next time there will be more handouts and less students, and so we will converge to some numbers. So for today, I'm sorry. These slides will be available on the course page immediately after the lecture. The first thing, usually, if you want to get a bit closer than analyzing the words, is to check in Wikipedia, and you find this very nice triad of different aspects of natural computation, which we will consider all but to different levels. As I mentioned, these three dots, are there any other interesting natural materials, for example, molecules or quantum dots, that allow us to do computation maybe in more efficient or in more efficient ways or in larger dimensions? Another problem is how to understand what is going on in different natural systems. Is there any possibility in the reverse direction to use computation in order to understand such phenomena? So a typical approach is to synthesize certain phenomena mechanisms inside your computer, and you hope that this is in parallel or in correspondence to natural phenomena. And if you are successful in doing so, then probably maybe you haven't understood everything about this particular phenomenon, but at least you have extracted some part of it and found explanation of certain aspects of these phenomena, and then you can refine your model in order to get closer to a solution. And finally, the third bit, which will be probably most of what we will be doing in this course, is to look at nature, whether there can be taken away any inspiration in order to come up with novel or more general or more robust or more efficient problem-solving techniques. To take this a little bit further, so for the first aspects, there have been always, since the existence of digital computers, have always been analog computers, just any kind of physical system which for some reason has, or by design usually, has similar dynamics or similar properties as a computational problem. And so by running this analog computer, you have a solution for one particular problem this analog computer was made for. Now there is other possibilities how to integrate kind of ideas of analog computers for particular purposes with digital computers, such as is tried in some implementation of smart matter. So for example, if you consider a bird flying, it has always this possibility to adjust single feathers in order to stabilize its flight, while airplanes usually cannot do it. So it might be a good idea to have small actuators, small measurement devices that can deform or the wing of the airplane in such a way that stability is enhanced. Another possibility of this kind of smart matter, that's what we have in our brains, so neural networks are just some kind of assembly of cells with particular interconnections, and these already allow us to do a lot of very interesting computations, maybe not exactly the same ones as we are used to find in the digital computers, but in some aspects very energy efficient and also very robust and general in a sense. So there are other possibilities. You may think of a kind of foam with a lot of small bubbles, and each bubble may contain other bubbles or may bump into other bubbles or combine with other bubbles. So this gives you a lot of operations which might be possible. And so by just considering these kind of complex membrane systems, it might be also a possibility, as has been pointed out by researchers, to construct a computer in this way. Other possibilities which we will also consider is these strands of DNA contain information and interact according to the information contained, and this allows also to solve computational problems very efficiently in very large scales. So we think today in computers on whatever tera scales, but if you're talking about molecules, you can add or you can multiply this number by a trillion. Although sometimes you have problems maybe with encoding or with noise in the system, which are trades up against. But these opportunities which are present in these natural materials are not or have not been sufficiently discussed so far, or not sufficiently deeply explored. And so there's a lot of things to learn by getting into this material computation. The second aspect, how to understand natural phenomena in computational models, is something which is done very regularly in most of the sciences today. So for example, in the computational neuroscience, some topic which we will not really discuss here very much because there are other specialized courses on this. We have very clear ideas what neurons are doing if expressed by equations or maybe all.
Could you maybe raise the volume?
Okay, I try so. There's no way to increase the volume. So
can
I.
Speak into the microphone in the middle of the desk.
Yeah, this might be, is it better if I speak so in this way, yeah? Better or not? Okay, so I will stay stationary. Okay, so there are a number of possibilities on a more axiomatic way, like in L systems, which you may have heard of. There's a possibility to consider simple mechanical simulations, which we use in our research to understand robot morphologies. Or there's a possibility to compute chemical reactions, for example, in biochemistry. And as if you try to do it seriously, then you see that the real world, as emphasized in the previous aspect, has much advantage above these computational methods. You know, if you want to compute how a particular protein of a few thousand bases folds, it takes you maybe hours on a good computer, but the protein itself does it in microseconds or faster. Such that it might be an option to consider the real thing rather than only the model, but of course there will be always this kind of interplay in understanding it computationally and using the properties of such systems. Finally, the third aspect, the inspiration from nature. There are in most of the subchapters of natural computing directly traceable origins in natural phenomena. Cellular automata have been proposed, 60 years ago, in order to have some kind of a model in the beginning of the reproducibility of living cells. And later it turned out that you can do a lot of other computations with cellular automata. Neural computation, also in the beginning, to understand how the brain works. And later you can just try to build up maybe small artificial brains that solve at least particular problems as well. And so in this way, a lot of these inspirations on various levels of biology or physics have made it into a computational formulation where you can use or exploit a particular trick that nature has invented to be able to cope with harsh environments or the problems which guarantee survival of a certain species. We will, I think, more or less discuss all of the red ones here. Amorphous computing, I'm not so sure whether we will get to this. And for the first two ones, I'm sure that there are other courses where these are dealt with in a more comprehensive way, and this is possible in this overview type of a lecture. So what we're aiming at is essentially problem solving. So problem solving here means simply you have some idea about a space of solutions, and you simply have to find a good solution among all of the possible ones. So these are usually huge spaces. We need to make sure that all good solutions are inside this space. And so how do you find solutions in general? So if you know how to do it, very good. You just take a program, run it, and you have applying a straightforward recipe, you will easily get to this particular solution. You just pick it out on the particular place it is in this space of solutions. But in many cases, this will not be possible, especially if you do not have a full understanding of your particular restrictions, interrelations, and special conditions of the domain you are dealing with. And so you have always a choice. Either you try to understand more about the problem and to come up with a more precise solution, or you try to be a little bit more sloppy in your approach while making sure that you still have a chance to get to the solution. And this is exactly the way which we will be going here. So we will be much more general in the sense that methods can be applied to a lot of different problems. On the other hand, it's often very easy to find better solutions just by investing more effort into the understanding of the problem. This might be often an option. Often it's maybe better really to ask an expert to assess the problem, to write a report, which costs a couple of thousands of pounds and takes possibly a couple of months. And if you don't have the time to wait for this or to acquaint yourself sufficiently with the problem, then these heuristic methods are possibly a way to go. So if you don't have a chance to directly calculate the solution, then maybe it's a possibility to take any other solution which is similar and to solve the problem by analogy. So you have tried this in a lot of similar cases, so why not try it also in the present case? In some particular questions, you will be able to prove even that it's generalizable also to the more related cases. If this is not really an option, then you can look to Cartesius and apply his method, divide and conquer, so to say. Maybe you can solve sub-problems. So you cannot really solve the full problem, but you solve a number of sub-problems, and possibly after doing so, you are able to recombine or to concatenate these sub-solutions into a solution which is maybe not the optimal one for the full problem, but is still reasonable in the sense that it's helping your practical purposes. There might be another way. So sometimes you have to start with any solution, and by applying it further and further to improve it iteratively. If you can make sure that in this way you have a continuous improvement, very good. Yeah. If you can really measure a gradient, you can just follow this gradient and you will also be better. So now we only arrive at the level of vagueness, which guarantees a successful application of the natural approaches to computing. So as soon as you are mainly relying on some kind of heuristics, yeah, then it's maybe a good idea to think a little bit whether this heuristics is maybe not just particularly suited for your present problem, but whether it's more generally applicable. So in the sense, this term meta heuristics is to be understood. So there might be some kind of common properties that are present in very different computational problems in different applications, although it's maybe not always obvious why this is so, but it's still maybe a good idea to give it a try. At least in this way, you make sure that you are better than just random guessing the last of the list, in order maybe by using certain structures of the problem. So for example, this Cartesian method, if you are able by formulating your solution in some kind of automated way, if you are able to pick out certain parts and maybe find good part solutions and leave it to your algorithm to combine them maybe in different ways, then you are definitely better than just trial and error. Or if you have this idea that if there is some kind of gradient which can guide you towards better solutions, if your algorithm picks it up, then also it will be some kind of improvement against this what is left, yeah, if you don't have any idea. So you just leave it essentially to the algorithm, both to come up with good solutions and to explore the particular features of the solution space that allow for certain approaches or to use particular structures in the problem. So this is very abstract. We will consider an example now, and a more a specific example in a while. Yeah, so this is the easiest approach how to continue as hill climbing. So you know, every one of you know this spot. So just assume your task is to find the highest mountain in the world, yeah, and you find yourself in this particular position. So what you do is, yeah, you just go up. And we have two advantages from this. First, yeah, you have already some kind of partial solution to your problem. And on the other hand, if you are up there, then you will see Arthur's Seat in a close distance. So you have already some additional information about the next best solution which is available. So it will might take some time in this way if you really reach at Mount Everest, but assume that it's not just you doing this, but maybe a couple of hundred or maybe a couple of million people in all the world that you find in some kind of news group. Then possibly one of them will arrive at the top of the world and can send a message to everybody. Yeah, I did it, and you have just by always going up and looking out for similar solutions to the problem, you have solved the problem. And so this kind of strategy, not only to use this kind of local information, but also to exploit the massive parallelism that is made available by a large populations of solutions, this is also something which is shared by most of the natural computing algorithms. So it's one particular way of improving the solution is maybe if you have a lot of communication among the searchers here. So if you can tell somebody how far you climbed up above sea level, then maybe he or she can let you know that it's not really worth spending time in this area and you should maybe take a plane to Nepal in order to start at a completely different level in order to solve this task. So hill climbing is something which is underlying to many algorithms, and we will deal with additional features that characterize this meta heuristic algorithms. So one particular obstacle to this kind of straightforward hill climbing is often that you are not really sure where you are going, you know, whether it's up or down. You have to do measurements of the height, you know, whether it's really improved or whether it has really improved or whether you just continued on an even level. This is similar to stochastic optimization, where you know, you have to do iterations and you hope that the noise averages out and you still follow some kind of noisy gradient among this. So here you don't really have a probabilistic problem, but because there is maybe some kind of population of solutions, you still have some similar situation where you have a number of outcomes and you can average over the outcomes or you can take maxima over the outcomes in order to find some kind of improvement, even if you are not really sure whether it's going up or down in a particular instance. There is, as I mentioned before, usually not the necessity to make particular assumptions or to verify particular assumptions about the problems. But the main assumptions which you have to do is that you need to be able to distinguish by some simple algorithm or by some procedure and a good from a poor solution, and in this way you can make sure whether it was worth to search in a particular subspace of the solution space or whether it's better to move ahead. So in this way it shares some similarities with this problem which is usually discussed in complexity theory when NP completeness is discussed. So it's often problems which are hard to solve, but you need some kind of easy way to verify the solution. So these meta heuristic algorithms have been applied to a number of NP complete problems. It's easy to do this, but it's not a solution in particular because usually you are happy with finding a good solution or a better solution rather than really to go for the optimal solution as it is required by the typical formulations in complexity theory. And therefore, it's not really solving the NP complete problem, but it's mainly a reliable tool for practical purposes. In particular, in the natural world, it's mainly important to survive. It's never really important to be optimal in any sense. And this is also a little bit heuristics or the philosophy behind this. These assumptions or no assumptions which we make here is a little bit compromised by the adjustable parameters these algorithms usually have. So you have some kind of possibilities to choose the population size or to choose some kind of mutation rates and things like this. And by these parameters, you can drastically, and I hope you will have a chance to do so in the assignments, drastically change the behavior of the algorithms. And of course, you need, in many cases, to adjust the parameters in such a way that you really get a very good solution rather than something intermediate. And so knowing what parameters, what parameter choices are helpful for a particular problem is in some cases as good as knowing more about the problem. But on the other hand, and that's why we do this course here, there are some kind of general ideas about how to tune these parameters independently on the particular problem, and in this way having some kind of a recipe how to approach problems even without this kind of specific domain knowledge. Okay, so this was for an introduction. Any questions so far? So maybe you don't have really questions at the moment. If you have suggestions, please let me know. No, everything is still in this kind of process of transition from GAGP, genetic algorithms and genetic programming, as it used to be called before, to this natural computing, and I will be very grateful for any comments in this direction. Or so we will, mainly for historical reasons, but also because the philosophy or the intuition in these meta-heuristic algorithms is particularly clear. We will start with genetic algorithms. So the genetic algorithms is simply a way of explaining, so to say, these very nice creatures that have been brought about by natural evolution. So it's often really puzzling or astonishing what level of detail or what particular mechanisms, if you go to bioinformatics or biophysics, then you see much more of them, which surfaced only recently, but it was always impressive to see animals dealing with an habitat, which, for example, by a robot could never really be conquered or inhabited in the same way. And so in this way, we really hope that by understanding more about these forces or dynamics that lead from or led from very simple organisms to very complex ecosystems in the end, if we understand more about these, then we will have really learned to deal with general problems. So this is one possibility to take a very abstract way to exploit maybe just a bit of these, which is of these problem-solving capabilities of life or of nature, which is tried in genetic algorithms, but it's maybe more and more attempted or approached to have a more comprehensive theory, because it's not just the genes which are translated into a living being, but there are a lot of other conditions during development or during learning, the immediate environment after birth, or in social interactions, which also help, of course, to create the value of a living being. In genetic algorithms, everything is quite plain. So what you start with is a genome and some kind of a relation between this genome and your problem space. This has some kind of history. So at Darwin's time, it was not really clear first what is a genome, and on the other hand also whether this relation can be really used for something else. But some people, that's why I have this kind of side remarks collected here, after this have discussed these possibilities. So one of the first was this science fiction author, Stanislav Lem. He thought that maybe if you write a novel, like this, his science fiction novels, you do essentially the same as natural evolution does. You develop characters, split them up into different groups of characters, or have some kind of interacting to form finally an ecosystem which the reader will enjoy. Another approach was taken by Dawkins, where he said that many ideas cultural inventions have a similar evolution like species in nature. And they don't live in the physical world, but they just live in our brains essentially, or maybe in some kind of printed matter. But they, in memetics, you describe the world of ideas in a very similar way. Gerald Edelman suggested in a very similar spirit the evolution of problem solutions in the brain, also by a kind of neural Darwinism. So there are different groups of neurons in the brain which represent particular solutions or subsolutions, and they fight against each other, they are selected or may be modified into different branches, and finally you end up with a good solution which comes up maybe next morning when you wake up after this neural evolution has taken place in the sleeping brain. There are similar approaches also to understand immune systems, which we will discuss probably later, and a number of different extensions and applications. So for example, it's always very interesting to combine these maybe mechanistic evolution as conceived by Darwin with individual learning capabilities. So there was this discussion whether individual can really transfer their personal achievements. Maybe they can't, yeah, but in our approaches, we still can make sure that they do if it's worth it. On the other hand, these types of interacting agents are maybe also good in order to understand markets or finance or social systems in general. The first more mechanical implementation of a similar principle, yeah, as a search algorithm, was by Ross Ashby. I don't know, he's not too famous. Also here on this image, he's depicted with three very famous scientists of this time. So on the left, this is Gray Walter, who constructed the first autonomous robots in history. On the right, this is Warren McCulloch, who is the father of what we call today computational neuroscience. The guy with the mustache is Norbert Wiener. He is maybe the father, if you wish, of what we today call informatics, or at that time it was called cybernetics. And finally was Ashby. And he was a little bit of a strange guy. I will not really go into these details. That's why probably he's less famous than the other ones. And he came up with what he called the homeostat. Yeah? It's a little bit hard to explain. Yeah? You have these four boxes, and each of the box on top has some kind of turnable magnet. Yeah? So there's a pivot, and on top of this pivot, the magnet can turn. And by turning, it does modify the position of a potentiometer. So this was realized at the time by some kind of a sausage-shaped tank of water. And inside this, there was some kind of electrical contact. And whatever the farther the current had to travel through the water, the larger the resistance of this potentiometer was. So if you turn one of these magnets, it changes an resistance or the voltage of a certain current line. And in this way, it influences four coils which are inside each of these boxes. And by influencing these coils, you may induce other rotations in the other magnets. Maybe it's a little bit easier to just consider, the mathematical formulation. So what you have is you have four quantities, x1 to x4, which have a number of different couplings among each other, which are represented in this matrix. And so each value of x1 influences each of the derivatives of the other ones. Yeah, so you may know what can happen in such a system. It can either die, so all the x go to zero, which means in this machine that all the turnable devices go to a resting state. It can diverge, yeah? So all the x go to, or some of the x go to infinity, which means in the machine that you just go to some kind of boundary and are stopped then. Or it can oscillate in a certain more or less complicated way, which also is observed in the machine sometimes. And so why did he build this machine? So he had this idea of ultra stability. So stability in a standard sense would mean you go back to set state, maybe to the zero position of the machine. Ultra stability means, assume there is some kind of evil engineer who takes out of this matrix or out of the machine here some of these contacts and replace it in some kind of random way, or by some kind of random element. And so in this way, you can completely change the properties of this dynamic. So ultra stability means also you have this kind of universal problem-solving device. Of course, it's not so universal because it's only for four variables. But it is not only stable, but it also survives structural impacts of the system. And it does it in a very simple way. At that time, the most advanced techniques was from this telephone selectors. So what you do, as soon as maybe you have this situation in the diagram on the right, that all the trajectories, the state evolution here just represented by two of the four dimensions, go away, then you detect that they go to some kind of boundary. And if this is the case, as shown here, then your telephone selector finds some random weight which is different from what was there before. It just explores randomly near this state where you are. And if you are lucky, then you jump to a different type of dynamics, just by changing one or maybe a couple of these coupling constants, and maybe you go back to your stable state. If not, then of course you just continue. Maybe you go to a different boundary, then you find other in other telephone selectors, you find other variables, and so in the end, you are bound to move to a stable state, or at least to some kind of slow oscillation, which remains in this. Sorry, I went back now in this viability zone. So what the idea was that living beings have this kind of mechanisms that even, for example, if you are infected by some virus, or some of the mechanisms are not working in the proper way, then you might not be able really to return to your optimal state, but you need to take some kind of excursions in the state space. You have to suffer some disease, but in the end, the impact of the evil engineer or of this bacteria is reversed, and you can really go back to the zone where you feel most well in. And this is a very simple mechanism. It took a lot of work probably to really construct the hardware for this. But in the first mentionings of genetic algorithms, they really went back to this homeostat as a kind of more general or more viable variable implementation of the same principle. So what we had seen here in the homeostat, there were these interaction parameters between the different dynamical components of the system. This is more or less what characterizes the system at a given time, which is a genetic code. So the genetic code can be also changed by recombination or mutation in a similar, maybe not exactly the same way, but often enough also in a similarly random way as these parameters by the telephone selectors, by the random telephone selectors in the homeostat. There is some way of identifying good solutions or telling them apart from bad solutions, which is called in genetic algorithms the fitness function or the fitness. This was more implicitly assumed as a viability, which was essentially the same inside the certain regions, and outside it was zero. There is electromechanical dynamics of the homeostat on the one hand side, and on the other hand, you need in some way to determine the fitness. So this will be very different for different algorithms. This mutation is reflected by these additional reactions on hitting the boundary on the viability, or maybe just the idea that the fitness could increase in genetic algorithms would also lead to a couple of mutations. So what is new in genetic algorithms in addition to these mutations from the homeostat is recombination, so some kind of maybe schematic form of sexual reproductions where you take genes of one individual and genes of a different individual and find some kind of new combination that might be better than what was there before. So this has been tried, so this is like the earliest successful application. Anything is, nothing is moving here, huh? Should be moving? No. This was a technical problem, how to design what is called flashing flow nozzles, so similar to what is inside an engine of a jet engine of an airplane. How you should construct it in order to maybe produce most forces from least fuel. And so what Schwefel did, he just made sure to get a large selection of different plates, all of them with holes inside. Well, these kind of square plates with some kind of holes inside of different diameters, and he arranged them into an order, random order, or maybe something what was a classical solution before, what was known before, what was given there, what was given up there, and then he ignited it and tested it, what was the power generated, or the force generated by it, and then he ran its 60s computer and asked the computer to have some kind of different arrangement for these plates. So the different order, maybe you just change, take one out and put another one in, or you exchange two, or maybe you have also this idea that you have a lot of these sequences of these plates stored in your computer, and you may also switch in a similar way as these sexual reproductions cross over or interchange parts of two individuals to get a new one. So he did so by hand a couple of days, and after this he arrived at this funny result down there, which is quite different from the starting configuration, and which just by this kind of automatic exploration without any kind of ideas of specialist ideas about combustion engines and so on, he arrived at a configuration which for some reason defies what was known in engineering before, and which is definitely more, or turned out to be more efficient than the more standard configuration. The question is, of course, other questions to be considered. Maybe it doesn't last so long with all these edges and so on, but it moved, so to say, from what was considered to be traditional safe knowledge about jet engines to a completely different solution, and you can now maybe try to understand what's going on here in the resulting engine, or you can maybe find some kind of ways at least to move some of the experience which you have made with these ones in the development of new engines. But it was somehow extremely successful that a lot of other applications flourished in many different areas. So here's one which is a little bit funny. If you have a box with Lego cubes and your task is you should have some kind of a bridge of the widest spanning width, using no other help than a single table. You cannot fix it on the table. It should have some kind of counterweight on the table, and on the other hand, it should extend as much into space. So in a very similar way as this engine, you just have a couple of arrangements in your computer. You mutate them. You choose the ones which are good, which provide you with large spanning width, and after a couple of generations, 100 or so, then you arrive at this particular solution. Maybe you can find better solutions if you are an engineer, but this is something you might not easily come up with just in a half afternoon with interest, as long as your interest in this task might last. Okay, so there are, of course, other possibilities. The problem is always if you have a good solution which you can test in the computer, it may not be really viable in the real world. So either you have very good models already, then this is less a problem, or you have particular problems which are easily transferred into a purely computational formulation. But there are other ways, for example, how to build robots here, or how to build walking robots. And these two authors, they try to find some way of having some kind, not only of an exploration algorithm, but also having some kind of automatization of the generation or the production of the result. So they had some kind of initial evolution of these structures, which consists essentially only of ball joints and of either stiff or extendable links between these ball joints. And it was completely up to the algorithm to find some kind of configuration where to place the motors and which parts to have movable or not. So this restriction to these particular components enabled to have a machine which directly from a computer received the latest results of the evolution and could test it out in a real setting. I don't know, it was not particularly successful, I must say, because these machines are in the end quite expensive. So if you want really to produce maybe tens of thousands of them, as natural evolution did, then it might be really, the cost factor might be limiting the success. But they had some funny results, like this tent shape, which essentially moves like a gondola in Venice by putting some downwards, or this maybe cancer-like being which turned out, which was never really considered by the design or in the design of the algorithm, which just started with a single ball which couldn't move at all, and which ended up in these creatures, if you wish. There are some other variants of genetic algorithms which are less close to biology. So one is genetic programming, which we will also discuss, where you are not really trying to evolve a certain solution, but really a particular program in the programming language of your choice, which is very helpful, for example, if you are discussing non-parametric fit problems, or if you have a certain time series and you are sure that there is some kind of mathematical law underlying to it and you would like to find it out. So these two, genetic algorithms and genetic programming, are part of what is called evolutionary computation. There are also more direct methods where you are not really referring to a genetic encoding of the problem, but really use the parameters of the solution in the evolution. And this evolutionary computation, to go back to where we started from, is one of the subjects in natural computation or computing, so it's not really preferable whether you say computation or computing in this context. And we will check a little bit among these ones. To go back to genetic algorithm will probably not be time today, but I should so I wanted to present here in simple example, which you might have a look at. So we will start next time with this one, or with a more systematic outline of genetic algorithms. I put here some reading suggestions, which are similar to what is on the web page. So now we have, or we almost have, this nice handbook of natural computing, but this is a 500 pounds volume, which probably is not really worth its money, so don't think of buying it. But what is a nice book, which is also available on the internet and which we will help in the next weeks at least, is this Introduction to Genetic Algorithms by Melanie Mitchell. Other books will be highlighted at later times. And here is some information about organizational matters. So there will be two assignments. One is a little bit cheaper and the other is a little bit larger, which will be probably due on 14th of October and 18th of November, as at least if we proceed that fast. I have my doubts now, but I will make sure that this will be possible. There will be an exam at semester two. So 70% for an exam is maybe less than what you get for other exams, but in this particular subject, I think it's really important that you do some practical exercises. That's why I try to increase a little bit the weights of the assignments. And there are a number of tutorial groups which you should subscribe to on the course page somewhere. Anybody knows, does not know where to enter his name in any of these groups? I don't know either, but I will find out. Yeah. So alternatively, we just take the standard approach, and I will bring some sheets next time. So this much for today. Thank you very much for joining, and I hope to see most of you next week again. On Friday again.
Yeah.